Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects today with P.J. Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And to start, we're going to talk about how insects talk to each other, and we'll cover this winter's cutworm population. And, of course, answer your questions as well. Are there any insects giving you a headache? How are you dealing with them? Join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And if you've got a photo of an insect you maybe want PJ to identify, or just for the fun of looking at it, you can email that in as well. PJ Leash, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here today, Larry.
So how do scientists know for sure that insects communicate?
Well, there's actually a lot of research on this topic. I mean, just as a member of the general public, when we observe insects, we can tell that they are communicating in certain ways. And if you think about communication in a very basic sense, it's the transfer of information from one entity to another. And insects can do this a lot of different ways, through visual cues, through sound or acoustic cues, chemical communication, which as humans, we don't do as much, but for insects, it can be very, very important. They can use tactile communication. So simply watching and observing insects, we can see this. Imagine watching dragonflies perched on a twig or branch near the water. We know dragonflies will often be territorial. You can have a male guarding a certain territory, and they often have specific patterns and colors on their bodies or wings, and that can be a way to perhaps communicate to others of their same species. So there's a lot of ways that they can do this. Another great example would be fireflies. Watching fireflies flash on a warm summer night, that's a very easy way. Perhaps one of the commonest ways that everyone learns about is seeing those fireflies flash. They're talking to one another. So there's really a lot of different ways that they can do it.
I was thinking about bees for a minute. Bees communicate tactile or physical contact, I guess you could say. And so what do they do when they're when they're doing that? Are they grabbing a hold and giving each other a hug, or what happens?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting topic. And when you think about honeybees, they can really communicate in a lot of different ways. And so even though I mentioned things like visual cues, acoustic, tactile and stuff, when insects go about their daily lives, they're often combining a number of these things. So honeybees have a fascinating behavior, for example, called the waggle dance. So you can have a worker honeybee that leaves the hive to go out and look for pollen and nectar. And if they find a good resource, maybe a patch of flowers that just came into bloom, they're going to come back and tell other members of their colony. And not only can they communicate this, they can communicate very specific information, such as what's the direction to fly in relation to the sun, how far away is it. They can use things like how enthusiastically they vibrate or waggle back and forth to tell some of this information, like how good the resource may be. So part of it is just vibrating their body, walking in a circular figure eight pattern. There's a lot of research that's been done on that waggle dance to get a better understanding of it. But that's a way that they can use this touch or tactile information tied in with some visual cues as well for that waggle dance to tell other members of the colony, hey, there's some food in this direction.
Yeah. Do they use sound at all? I mean, do they buzz in a certain way? We've got a honeybee buzz. Let's get a honeybee buzz.
Yeah, so if you hear a sound like that, I mean, a lot of insects are simply producing sound as kind of an artifact of their wings physically moving.
Okay.
One thing that is cool to me, though, about insect sounds like that, there's this growing body of research where I have colleagues, for example, studying those sounds and using technology to understand what's going on. So historically, if you wanted to understand what bees are visiting flowers and what time, for example, you might have to go out and spend 12 hours out in the field that day watching bees, or in some cases, catching bees to understand the different species that are present. You have to catch and kill some to be able to do that. But what if you could train a computer to listen for the exact sound frequencies? If we could identify that this insect has a frequency A and this other species has frequency B, you could train a computer to listen for that and then figure out patterns. There's a lot of cool research that is expanding in this area of computer learning and using technology, listening to some of those sounds produced by insects to better understand them.
What's an example of a bug that, or an insect that uses chemical communication?
Oh, there's lots. And it really depends on what the purpose of that chemical communication is. And there's a lot of different things that you could do with chemicals. One that comes to mind right away would be for mating purposes. You might have a species where a female moth, for example, will release a pheromone. One very good example that someone may call in about today because it's kind of a hot topic, but spongy moth, which used to be called gypsy moth. It's an invasive species. For that particular species, the females have wings, but they can't fly. And so to kind of advertise to the males where she is, she will release a pheromone. So that's a chemical signal. The males are capable of flight, so they basically smell that plume of chemical in the air and will fly upstream to find the female. So that's one way that chemicals could be used. We could use chemicals for insects in other ways. You could use it defensively. Think of something like a stink bug, which many of us have maybe experienced.
Yes.
If you squish them, it's going to smell pretty bad. Well, if a predator were trying to eat that insect and they release this bad-smelling scent or odor, that may make the predator think twice, and that insect therefore survives. And there's other ways they can use it as well. One really cool example would be with certain types of bark beetles. And if you've heard of bark beetles out west decimating parts of forested areas in Colorado and into British Columbia, places like that, the bark beetles can actually have a signal to tell other members of the same species that the tree that they are in is basically full. If more beetles kept showing up to the same tree, they'd run out of resources and some would starve. But they can send a chemical signal that says, this tree is full, go to a different tree. So there's really a lot of cool ways that insects can communicate using chemical signals.
Very interesting. You know, you mentioned fireflies. And when you mentioned fireflies, I thought of the park out east where they light synchronously.
Yeah. Fascinating. the fireflies we see around here, they don't quite have that behavior. If you go out in a grassy field in mid-July, you know, you see them blinking at different times. There are some species, though, called synchronous fireflies, where they all flash at the same time, and there may be a couple potential reasons for it that may simply enhance the overall signal. If they're synchronized so that perhaps members of the same species could see it from farther away. But also it might serve a little bit of a defensive purpose. If a predator is trying to find you to eat you, and all of a sudden the signal flashes from everywhere at the same time, it might disorient them and make it harder for them to cue in on a specific individual. So there could be a couple different potential reasons for that sort of behavior.
And what are our fireflies lighting up for? Is it for mating purposes?
Yeah, for the most part, it is mating purposes. Mm-hmm. However, there is a particular type of firefly that has a little bit more sinister use of flash patterns in certain situations. And what they will do is females of this firefly species will emit a flash pattern of a different species. So in comes this male firefly thinking he's found a mate of his own species. Mm-hmm. It's a female of a different species that when the male lands, she eats him. So sometimes chemical or communication can be used for more nefarious purposes, if you will.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, sound here, and insects, you know, as we've been talking about, communicate through sound. A cricket's chirp is one example. I think most everybody has heard one before, but Trina, why don't you go ahead and play a... I had one of those in a bedroom closet once, and it drove me crazy until I found it. But what is a cricket using to make that sound?
So with crickets, they actually take parts of their wings and rub them together. A close relative, but slightly different, would be grasshoppers, which do it a little bit differently. They rub their legs onto other body structures, for example. But with crickets and katydids, it's more of rubbing those wings together, almost like a violin, to produce those sounds for mating purposes.
It's for mating purposes. Well, I don't know who that cricket wanted to mate with in my bedroom closet, but I'm sure that cricket didn't find one, and I finally found the cricket. So there you go. Cicadas, though, they're another noisy bug.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and we have a bunch of different species of cicadas, but here in Wisconsin, we mostly think of them as being kind of like a midsummer, those hot dog days of summer, as you call them. And there's actually a type of cicada called the dog day cicada, which is very well known for some of the sounds it produces.
Yeah, have you got that, Trina? Yeah, that could be irritating if it goes on and on and on forever. But talk about that sound.
Yeah, so with cicadas, they produce sounds a little bit differently compared to the crickets and grasshoppers I just mentioned. So they actually have a membrane on their body called a timbal. And this is a stretched-out, taut membrane. So it's kind of like a drum, if you will. And they can vibrate that membrane, and that can produce these sounds. So when we hear cicadas like that, it's generally the males producing sounds to
Oh.
call in females. Although with some cicada species, the females can produce sounds as a response, especially when they get in close. It's usually not as pronounced, though. I know I have seen a video clip narrated by David Attenborough where he is mimicking the female cicada sounds, and basically sounds like he's clicking his fingers. It's just these short little snaps, whereas the males are playing these much longer, more elaborate kind of buzzing or whining noises for mating purposes.
We found another unique sound from the Death Watch beetle. It's a brown beetle. Why don't we play that first? Wow. Interesting sound. Why is it making that sound, or how is it making that sound? I think I could almost produce that that I'm doing right now on the table here.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually very similar to that, Larry. It's basically knocking, but instead of using your hand to knock, with these insects, they're basically using their heads. They live inside tunnels in wood, and they basically are banging their head against the wood. And the thought behind this is it may be for mating purposes, because you may have a big, say, oak wooden beam. You have some of these death watch beetles, as they're called, living inside the wooden beam. And it's dark, so they can't use visual cues. A chemical cue like a pheromone isn't going to move very well through these tunnels, but they can sit there and bang their head, make these little knocking noises, and that may help males and females find each other. So that's a interesting one that a lot of folks probably haven't heard that type of insect sound before.
Can they infect growing trees along with the old timbers and old buildings?
Yeah, so actually the group of beetles that those belong to, there's a whole bunch of different species, and some of them will go to trees in the woods. I usually don't think of them, though, going to healthy, robust trees. These play more a role in the natural ecosystem, if you will. If you have standing dead or dying trees, they may get into those, but they're really not the type of insect that goes up to healthy trees and starts feeding on those.
Let's take a call from Mary in Rubicon. Mary, hi.
Hey, Larry. Good to talk to you. I was just going to comment. I heard about the fireflies you were talking about, the Synchronia. It's in Kentucky in the National Forest. There's every spring, well, it's actually into June and July. June, they have a lottery to go see them because so many people want to come. So you actually have to apply in a lottery. I haven't been able to get tickets yet, but I keep trying. So I just wanted to tell you, they just look awesome, from their website, and it is in Kentucky.
Mary, thank you very much. I have seen video of that, and it really is amazing, isn't it, BJ?
It is. I mean, when you think about some of these natural phenomena, it is just spectacular to think about them or see video clips. I'd love to go see it in person myself. I've never had that opportunity. I have heard of the kind of the ticketing raffle system so that folks can set up a time and reserve because there's a lot of demand to do this, and there's only so many parking spots in some of these locations like Great Smoky Mountains.
Yeah. PJ Leash, our guest today. He's director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Trina LaSousa playing our insect sounds and engineering for us, and Clara Neipert's our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Had some fun talking about how insects communicate. We've been playing some songs. And we'll also take your questions. Maybe you've got a problem at home with an insect or just a question about an insect or maybe a photo you want to share. If you've got a photo or a question, that way you could certainly go online to ideas@wpr.org. Or if you have a question you want to call in, the number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Give a call. The Madagascar hissing cockroach is named after the sound it makes, and Trina's got that one too. Let's listen. Sounds like a hiss to me.
Definitely. So these are fascinating creatures, Larry, and a lot of pet stores will actually carry these. They can make pretty easy to care for pets. Here in my lab on campus, I have a big aquarium tank full of them because they're convenient for outreach purposes. But as you just mentioned, they produce this audible hissing noise, and hence the name Madagascar hissing cockroach. And they can actually make that noise or use it for a lot of different ways. Now, first off, how do they produce this hissing sound? Well, insects don't have lungs. So the way that they breathe is they have these little pores or openings on the side of their body called spiracles. Through those spiracles, there are structures called tracheae. They're essentially air tubes, if you will, and those branch finer and finer. So insects have air ducts running throughout their body. Now imagine if you had a soda straw and you blew air through it very quickly. It's going to make kind of a whooshing or hissing noise. So these insects can compress their body and the air can rush out of those air ducts and it makes the hissing noise. Now they can actually do this a lot of different ways. Now to humans, to our ears, we're really going to have a hard time picking out some of the differences. They can use these hissing noises as a general disturbance. So if I go in the back room of my lab and turn on the light quick, sometimes some of those hissing cockroaches will hiss. It's just kind of a disturbance, you know, hey, you're bugging me right now kind of thing. They weren't expecting the light to be flipped on. So that might serve a little bit of an alarm purpose. If a predator were trying to eat him and they hiss, might give him a split second to escape. They can also use it. The males will compete with each other, kind of grapple and wrestle and hiss as they're doing this. So competition, they use it for attracting mates. And actually during copulation as well, they will hiss. So they can use it in a number of different ways, these hissing noises. And if you had a special machine to record this, you could see very subtle differences in the length and amplitude of these hisses that they produce for different purposes.
Very, very cool. Well, a different topic here. Lynn in Waukesha emailed us. They had a lot of Asian ladybugs, and now they seem to have fewer, but stink bugs are around now, and Lynn's wondering if the stink bugs are eating the Asian ladybugs.
Yeah, good question. So the stink bug you're seeing is going to be a newer one called the brown marmorated stink bug. It first showed up here in Wisconsin back around 2010. Things were quiet for about 5 years or so. But today, certain parts of the state, south central Wisconsin, southeast Wisconsin, Fox River Valley, we have a pretty heavy presence of these insects. Now, just like Asian lady beetles, they like to sneak indoors in the fall. They're seeking out a sheltered spot where they can overwinter. Now, when they come indoors, they're not eating Asian lady beetles. Even when they're outdoors, they're not either. Asian lady beetles are predators. They feed on aphids. These stink bugs are plant feeders. So they love to feed on fruits and veggies in your garden and things like that. So tomatoes, peppers, sweet corn, various fruits like apples and things like that. So they're not directly competing with each other. But when you look at the bigger picture, insect populations always are fluctuating over time. It could be due to environmental reasons, weather patterns, and things like that. So in general, the Asian lady beetle populations were fairly high about 2-3 years ago. They've since gone back down, whereas in some parts of the state, we have this newer invasive stink bug species that has really been increasing its population. So again, it's not that they're competing with each other. It's just that we have these two species that are trending in different directions.
PJ Leash, our guest, give a call with your question at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to Susan in Peoria, Illinois. Hi, Susan.
Hello, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, my mom has an infestation, or has had an infestation of, I think the guy calls them Indian moths. I call them like pantry moths.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about? Those little moths that I think sometimes come in, like, you bring them home from the grocery store and their food and stuff.
Yeah, and you're wondering how is she going to get rid of them?
Yeah, I mean, we've had the guy come in and do whatever he does, but we still seem to find moths every once in a while.
Okay. Yeah, so there is a very, very common type of moth called the Indian meal moth, and we would consider this a type of pantry moth. Occasionally, there are some other species that pop up. But when I think of moths in a kitchen or in a home, probably about 80 to 90% of the time, it's going to be the species Indian meal moth. And the story with them is the caterpillars live in and feed on and develop in plant-based food materials for the most part. So when I see these or encounter them indoors, my first general management recommendation is not to spray anything at all. What you really need to do is pin down and locate the source where those caterpillars are developing. That can be in human foods, pastas, dry goods, if you have bulk seeds or grains or something like that. They can be in other plant-based materials, dried herbs, dried spices, sometimes decorative items, you know, dried decorative corn for Thanksgiving, things like that, strings of peppers, even potpourri on occasion, dried chocolates, bulk nuts, things like that, even pet food. So what you really need to do is look through your pantry, your kitchen cupboards and whatnot, find the item or items, plural, that the caterpillars are living in, and either discard those, or if it's, say, pet food and the pets won't mind so much, you could take that and just freeze that item. I would throw it in the freezer for about 2 weeks. If you do that and you locate all the food sources that they're living in, that will be the end of the situation. Occasionally, it can get a bit more complicated. For example, if you were in maybe an older house with a history of rodent problems, mice will sometimes take food items and stash them in tucked away spots, behind cabinets, in wall voids, things like that. That can be a little bit tougher to deal with. But again, first I would thoroughly inspect every item in the pantry or kitchen. Sometimes it's just an old box of Bisquick that's been there for 10 years or something like that. And once you clean it up, that will be the end of the problem. Another precaution is you're going through the cupboards. If you have items that don't show any signs of insect activity, keep them inside a container that seals up well, a Tupperware with a lid, Ziploc bags, things like that. If you just have like a box of cereal and the bag is kind of loosely closed in there, that could be a little bit higher risk where these might get in. One other very common place I see them in is bird seed. So if you have bird seed, maybe if you keep it indoors, that could be definitely something I would look at, or in your garage as well. But again, you have to look for and find the infested food items. If you clean that up, you usually don't need to spray for these whatsoever.
And Susan, thank you very much for calling. I want to turn to those snow worms or snow cut worms. What are these winter or snow cut worms?
Yeah, so once we get into December, for my caseload at the insect diagnostic lab, things quiet down quite a bit because it's cold outside. Not a whole lot of insects are active. There are some, though, that can be active at pretty cool temperatures. We're all generally familiar with like the black and brown woolly bear caterpillars. But there's a type of cutworm caterpillar that we commonly call the winter cutworm because the larvae, which are often mature late into the year, they'll overwinter as mature caterpillars and then transform to adult moths the following year in spring, for the most part. Those can sometimes wander at low temperatures. So in December, not that long ago, I was getting a whole bunch of emails about these. Folks were spotting them out wandering on the snow. Maybe it was a day where the air temperature was 25, 27, so just below freezing. You're really not expecting to see large numbers of these caterpillars, but in some cases, I had a gentleman email me out in his wooded area in northern Wisconsin. He was seeing like hundreds of these or thousands of them wandering around on the snow, which would really have you scratching your head. Occasionally, they can also sneak into structures, usually not in huge numbers, but sometimes they'll get into garages or homes because, again, when it's cool but not too cold, they just seem to wander around. And from their point of view, they would want to hunker down, spend the winter, and then go about their business the following spring.
And cutworms can cause some damage.
Well, they can. There's a lot of different species of cutworms and closely related armyworms. So if you're a farmer, for example, Larry, there's a lot of species you need to pay attention to, and even true for home gardeners as well. For this winter cutworm, it's technically not a native species. They're originally from Europe. We had our first reports in North America, I think from the 1970s or so. Very common in Europe. Now it's pretty common and widespread in the eastern parts of the U.S. For the most part, they don't really seem to cause a whole lot of damage. There are a few reports out there in very unique situations where maybe their populations are sky high. They might cause a little bit of crop damage or damage to plants and yards like hostas and things like that. Otherwise, I mostly think of them as more of a curiosity, something you bump into every now and again, but usually not causing notable plant damage. So that's some good news about them.
Yeah, that's for sure. And those winter worms, I mean, they're up on top of the, you know, what happens to the ones that manage to make it up to the top of the snow? Or do they die or can they get back down?
Good question. Yeah, they're going to wander around for the most part until they find a sheltered spot. So if this were a home yard, you know, if they're wandering around, they may bump into and encounter a structure, a home, a shed, garage, maybe a firewood pile and crawl into kind of a more sheltered location. I have read some reports about these where there was a situation in Michigan about 15 years ago, just huge numbers of these winter cutworms. And at the time, the thought was if it gets really cold, you know, temperatures down at night towards zero and things like that, it would probably kill them off. And that wasn't the case. So they do seem to be pretty cold tolerant. Even if they're caught out at some cold temperatures, you're unlikely to be lethal, but they probably wander around until they find a little bit more sheltered location. And if they get down under the snow, then they're going to be pretty well insulated at that point.
And you said they're not native to Wisconsin?
Right.
What's the history of them?
Yeah, so they're actually a really common species across parts of Europe. They feed on a very wide range of plants. So if you were a very host-specific insect, you only fed on one type of plant, and if that plant weren't here in North America, you wouldn't have a chance. But this is a species with a very broad host range, so we don't know exactly how they got into North America. But they've been here probably going on maybe close to 50 years or so,
yeah.
Pretty widely distributed. But again, even though they're scattered around, they usually don't seem to cause too many problems out there in terms of damaging plants. To be honest, I see them in my own backyard on occasion in low numbers and just kind of say, oh, that's interesting to see some of these amongst my lawn, but no lawn damage notice from them.
PJ Leish, our guest today, questions for him. Give a call. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Ralph emailed us with a question. In October, he heard a cicada-like call coming from a patch of oak trees And he heard it even after dark. It was spring, and or if it was spring, he would have thought it was tree frogs, but wondering what they might have been. This is in October.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, one thing that comes to mind, and that would be a good question for David Drake as well, next time he's on. From what I've read about some of our frogs, you know, they may have a certain period of time where they're calling in spring or early summer, something like that. But sometimes some of those species may call later in the year on occasion. But I can also think of plenty of insects, and without hearing the specific sound in this case, it's really hard to narrow it down. When I think of insect sounds at night, though, not so much cicadas. Those are more during the day. But at night, there's a long list of other insects that can call, from crickets to katydids to things we call tree crickets. A lot of the noises at night that you're hearing tend to be katydids and tree crickets. One cool way that you can kind of investigate this further, so if that individual hears this sound again next year, there's a website called songsofinsects.com. And if you go there, you can listen to audio clips of a long list of these different types of insects. And so you can listen to the clips and compare it to what you're hearing out in your yard or your neighborhood. And that's often a way that you can narrow down who or what it may be that's out there making that noise. So definitely could have been something along the lines of katydid or tree cricket. But without an audio recording, it's hard to really know for sure in this case.
And what's the name of that site again?
It's songsofinsects.com.
Okay, songsofinsects.com. And speaking of songs, James emailed us a number of years ago. He heard about a recording of a jungle at night, and they played it with the speed of the recording, and it came out with a song.
Oh,
and they came out with a song. Did you ever hear that song? Or was it real?
I have not heard that myself. Many years ago, I spent a little bit of time in the rainforest in Belize. Mm-hmm. And just cool to experience that and hear the different sounds from vertebrates and invertebrates as well. But anytime you move around the globe, there's going to be some different sounds out there. So fascinating to listen to.
Lisa in East Troy emailed us. She's had the woolies come into her barn for winter and wonders what she can do with them. She has to move them so they don't get hurt, and wonders if they hatch into moths and should she put them back outside.
Yeah, that's another really common question I've had recently, Larry. In addition to those winter cutworms, lots of sightings of those woolly bear caterpillars, those kind of ubiquitous brown and black ones. With those particular insects, they can also be active at pretty cold temperatures, usually not as cold as the winter cutworms. But I get a lot of reports in months like November where the air temperature might be 40 to 50 degrees. They kind of wander around. They will spend the winter sometimes as caterpillars like that and can actually tolerate the cold quite well. From my point of view about those, you wouldn't want to take those caterpillars and bring them in to a nice warm indoor location. And that's often what folks do intuitively. They think this caterpillar must be cold. I got to bring it indoors. Well, from the insect's point of view, if you do that and it turns into an adult moth, it's all alone. It has no other members of its own species. If it, you know, if you had two of them and they mated, they're not going to have food for the eggs and caterpillars and things like that. So for them, it would really be best to have them outdoors in a cold location. Doesn't necessarily have to be outdoors. You could put them in a container in a corner of a barn or in an unheated shed or something like that, or a part of a garage. Or you could also put them just outdoors in a somewhat sheltered location, maybe a firewood pile or something similar to that, where they're going to be sheltered a bit. I wouldn't want to take them if they were semi-active in a somewhat warmish barn, say it's in the 40s or something like that. If you took them from those conditions and put them, you know, outdoors on a day when it's minus 10, that might be a pretty hard shock on their system. But otherwise, it's okay to put them outdoors in a sheltered spot. They do fine under those conditions. They'll hunker down. They basically just become lethargic as it gets colder. And then in spring, they'll go about and finish their business. But they do turn into a moth as well.
Mary in Mountain emailed us. She's got a fungus. She has fungus gnats in one of her house plants. There's lots of tricks online, but she's looking for expert advice on how to rid her plants of fungus gnats.
Yeah, so my first recommendation in a case like that is if the plants can tolerate it, to cut down on watering quite a bit. And also, if you think about house plants indoors, this time of the year, they don't get a whole lot of sunlight. They don't need a whole lot of water either. And overwatering them will lead or can contribute to problems with things like fungus gnats. So with fungus gnats, the larvae, these little whitish worm-like creatures, live in the soil where they feed on decomposing plant matter, fungal spores, stuff like that. And they need and thrive in moist, damp conditions. So if we simply water less and it dries out more between waterings, that's going to be very hard on those insects, and it's going to make it much harder for them to survive. So in my own office here on campus, I have some indoor plants. I had some fungus gnats a couple years ago. The only thing I did was cut back on watering. They disappeared on their own. A couple other options. You might have a plant, for example, that can't tolerate going longer without water. There are some sticky traps you can get at most hardware stores or garden centers. They usually come with stakes or these yellow index card things with sticky glue on it. Through attrition, that may get some of the adults stuck. That may help. That can A, control them to a certain extent, but B, can be helpful for monitoring purposes. If you replace those over time and last month you caught 50, this month you caught 2, that tells you populations are going down. So that can be helpful in really bad situations or in like greenhouse settings or interior, you know, tropical botanical garden, stuff like that. There are some insecticides that can be used drenched into the soil where you can target the larvae there. But usually trying to spray for the adults doesn't accomplish much of anything. But again, drying things out is often the single best approach that you can do to help deal with these.
PJ Leash, our guest, he's director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Labs. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got an insect question that you've been thinking about a while. Maybe you've got something that's happening right now in your house you want to ask about. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. We had Randy email us a picture, and PJ will get a look at that in just a minute. But I want to remind you also that you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at the world of insects today on the show with PJ Leash, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, Larry Mueller here. Randy emailed us a picture. He found this structure in the inside, in the handle of a plastic tote. And it almost looks like army fatigue style cloth there. PJ, can you see it?
Yeah, I've got the picture open in front of me. And one of the first impressions to describe this, it almost looks a bit like if you had a greenish hand-rolled cigar or something like that. You can tell it's made of dried plant material, and it's kind of cylindrical, tubular in structure, called a type of leafcutter bee. And what these insects do, they're solitary bees. They have small nests. They don't sting. They're specifically looking for pre-existing tubes. So out in nature, they may find a hollow plant stem. They may go to a tree in the woods where another insect has tunneled out and left that tunnel in the wood, and they may go in there. They're looking for holes that are usually about a quarter inch diameter, so about the diameter of a pencil. But sometimes man-made objects have somewhat similar features. So sometimes these insects will go to features on siding or near windows. But if you imagine the plastic handle as a bucket handle, there's that hole in there. They might go in there. And what these insects do, they go to plants. They use their mouth parts just like scissors. And they'll sit there and they'll snip off a round cylindrical piece of plant leaf. They then go back to their nest. They fold that up, roll it in there, and basically paste it together. So they're lining the tube-like structure with plant leaf material. That's going to help regulate the microclimate, the humidity, and things like that. then they actually produce little rooms or cells or chambers inside of that where they stash food for their young. So pollen, they're going to lay an egg and then glue it shut with more leaf material. And they do this again and again throughout this tube. So they might make 6 or 8 or 10 of these little rooms where their young will develop. So that's what this is, a nest from a leafcutter bee.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. Susie in Menasha, we go to you now. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I have a teensy tiny fly in my house now. It's smaller than a fruit fly, and I see them in the bathroom and around sinks. And they do get into other rooms of the house. They're pretty easy to smash. But I think they're coming out of the sink. Is that possible?
Yeah, that is possible. In a case like this, I would say it would be really helpful for me to probably see some physical specimens of these insects. With the small size, it's probably going to be hard to photograph them. And when I think of small flies indoors, there's a long list of possibilities, and each has a slightly different story to tell. There is a type of small fly, for example, that we commonly call a moth or a drain fly. And that's usually the number one spot they come from, would be drains or sinks. If it were that insect, it would tell us there's some organic gunk that is built up. But if it's a different insect, that could be telling us that there is a different story. We just had a caller ask about fungus gnats, for example. And sometimes fungus gnats can be present in homes from other things like houseplants, but they may go into bathrooms or kitchens where there's moisture in the sink. They're just kind of drawn to the moisture, but those drains wouldn't be the source of those insects. So what I would actually recommend in this case would be to try and collect some of these insects and send them into me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. That way I can look at them under the microscope, let you know exactly what they are. And once we know what they are, then we can understand their story, what they're doing, where they're coming from, and what we can do about them. So that would be my recommendation. And to do that, I would hop online and do an internet search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and you should be able to find my site with all the info in terms of how to send in a sample.
All right. There you go, Susie. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Sue in Menominee, Michigan, we turn to you next. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a rose garden. I have other perennials in there, and I've been doing this for years. And then last year I was on vacation. It was rather dry, and I came home and only the rose flowers petals. They had like brown spots, and then the leaves were just like gone. So I sprayed. The flowers would still be there, but they weren't nearly as robust as usual, but that was probably because it was so dry. So I sprayed neem oil on them, and it seemed to stop it, although a lot of them already had all their leaves gone. And I did see some leaves come back after that. Now, I cut them down in the fall, or, you know, whatever you call that, and deadheaded or whatever. And what should I expect this spring? Should I start out spraying some neem oil before they start to grow, or just wait and see what I get?
Yeah, good question. In a case like this, I can think of a number of different types of sawflies that can feed on roses, especially during the spring and early summer months. So that would be something I would keep an eye out for. When I think of neem as a product, though, so neem oil, the way that it works is it has to be sprayed directly onto an insect, a soft-bodied insect. It gets in breathing pores, and it essentially smothers and suffocates them. So if there's no insects present at that time, spraying neem oil really does nothing. It does not work as a preventative type treatment, anything like that. It only works when the insects are present and you spray them with it directly. So what I would really recommend in a case like this would simply be to wait and watch and keep a close eye on those rose bushes this spring. If you start seeing any little holes in leaves, leaves missing, that sort of thing, especially from early on in the season onwards, if you notice damage, flip over the leaves and check the undersides. There's some of these sawfly species that look kind of caterpillar or slug-like. And they blend in pretty well in terms of their coloration. So they're a little bit harder to see. But if you see those present, these kind of slug-like, worm-like creatures, those you can control pretty easily with either neem oil or insecticidal soap. But it's a matter of spraying them directly. And if they're on the undersides of the leaves, you have to get good spray coverage. So that's probably what I'd recommend at this point, is wait and watch until next spring and keep a close eye on things.
There you go, Sue. Thank you for calling. Norman in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Norman.
Good morning. I got a question for my good friend P.J. Leash, who helps me out periodically. I have a couple of nice Meyer lemon plants that, as we speak, have little lemons on them and blossoms and everything else. The problem I have is one of those picked up scale insects. They didn't have any when I brought them in from the deck a few months ago. And about a month and a half ago, I noticed that there was, looks like, little droplets of water or something, which is really the honeydew, I guess, off of these scale insects. And I looked, and the one plant had actual adult scales on them. So I picked off the scales with a toothbrush as best I could over the sink and washed them with soapy water and rinsed them off and dried them. But I'm concerned, A, where they probably came from inside our sunroom, and B, what can I do? I've sprayed them with a thing called Flea Halt, which is a spray for fleas and ticks on dogs, and it contains pyrethrins, piperonyl butoxide, and permethrin. And I haven't had them come back that I can see for sure, but I wonder what a person could do beyond what I did if they do come back.
Yeah, and Larry, I know you've got a, well, you have a lime tree at home, don't you?
Yeah, limey.
Yeah,
and scale can be a problem.
They can, yeah. Some good news when I, you know, hear about a situation like this, the scale population probably was not huge, would be my suspicion, because this was a plant that was brought outdoors for a relatively short period of time, then brought back indoors, versus a plant that is outside all the time, scale populations sometimes build up. So the kind of drippy, sticky-looking stuff, that's honeydew secreted by scale insects, and things like aphids can as well. In terms of managing these, sounds like you have done a couple of good things. I often recommend, especially for smaller plants where it's feasible, physical removal. So it sounded like you used a toothpick, Norm, or fine forceps or something like that to physically remove them. That can be a little bit time-consuming and tedious, but you're removing those insects from the plants and stopping any future damage from those particular individuals. So that can be helpful. Sometimes with insects like this, we can actually take a Q-tip dipped in rubbing alcohol and dab that onto them directly. So that can be another helpful approach. So if you still have some around, the physical removal, the Q-tip with rubbing alcohol can help. There are sometimes insecticides that can be used for indoor plants like this, so some sprays. And if you went to the garden center, you could ask. They're going to have some sprays that are approved for indoor plants, and often it's going to contain things like pyrethrins or permethrin. One thing to keep in mind, though, if it's a product only has pyrethrins in it as the ingredient, that's a botanical-type product, that's very short-lived. So you could spray it on the plant. It might only work for a day or two tops. So there's no residual protection versus something like permethrin would work longer. But again, you'd need to check at a garden center and ask about specific ones for indoor plants. Now, technically, there are also some systemic treatments that in theory can be applied to the soil. They move upwards, offer protection. One caveat I have in my mind with those, though, when I've seen them for indoor plants, it's usually plants that we are not eating. I don't think on the label for those systemic products, they would allow you to use it on something like a lemon where you may be eating those lemon fruit from it. So that's just a heads up that those are probably not an option. But otherwise, I'd kind of stay the course with physical removal, diligent inspection, and some contact sprays if needed, especially if you keep a close eye on it and you see some of the juvenile scales active.
There you go, Norman. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And George in Wausau, do you have a question?
Yes, I caught a cricket and held it in my hand, closed my hand, and I got what felt like an electric shock, like an alternating current shock. I always wondered what that was.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting observation. I mean, a few things come to mind as possibilities. The first is that sometimes grasshoppers, crickets, if you were to capture one in your hand, if they felt threatened, they might simply bite. Depending on how sharp their mandibles are, their mouth parts are, that could potentially feel like a pinch or potentially a shock. Another possibility is, depending on the species, sometimes these insects, and a lot of insects in general, have a series of spine-like structures on the legs, and they have little claws at the ends of their legs as well. And that might, depending on if the insect is moving and whatnot, produce kind of a tingling, perhaps a shock-like sensation as well. So I think it was more due to physical kind of poking you, and that would explain it.
George, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us a photo or a question to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. And join Joy in Madison, who's got a call for us. But we'll take that right after we take a quick look at the news. So you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at insects on the program today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, PJ Leash. PJ is manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And I'm wondering, have you seen a strange insect in or around your home? What other questions might you have for PJ? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. And if you've got a photo, shoot that along with your email as well. Joy and Madison, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, this is a different slant on things, but I'm one of those people that walks spiders outside gently if I can during relatively good weather. And sometimes when I'm having coffee on the patio, a bug will fly into my coffee, and usually it's not very hot. So, is there a way, and I sometimes try to pull them out and put them on a napkin or something and see if they can revive themselves. Is there a way to stop an insect from drowning if they don't have lungs?
Yeah, interesting question. Since they don't have lungs, they basically have these little pores or spiracles on the side of their body going to air ducts throughout their body. So what I've generally observed with insects is if they fall into water, could be your cup of coffee or, you know, a lake or pond or something like that. If it's an insect that is not aquatic and some water gets in those spiracles, it does definitely kind of shut things down. However, once you get them out of water, they usually seem to revive, although it can take quite a while. I remember several years ago being up on the shores of Lake Superior in Bayfield County and finding some insects in the lake that must have been there for quite a while, assumed that they were dead, brought them out onto the beach and had them just lying down on the sand. And an hour later, they come to. So I think sometimes it's just a matter of allowing times for water to evaporate and dissipate from the body.
Interesting. Joy, thanks very much for calling. Carol in Green Bay called, couldn't stay with us. She's had experience with pantry moths or pantry pests. You can go to the hardware store and get pantry moth traps. What do you think?
Yeah, so I forgot to mention that earlier. I'm glad Carol had called in with that information. So there are indeed some pheromone traps, and we talked about chemical communication, pheromones a little bit at the beginning of the show, Larry. So with Indian meal moths and some of these other pantry moths, the females will release a pheromone, to attract males for mating purposes. What we can do with these traps is they have a sticky card trap. So there's no pesticide. It's just really sticky glue on it. And inside you can put this little capsule that has a synthetic version of the female sex pheromone. So the males smell this. They think they're going to find a female. They fly into the trap. They get stuck. Now, you have to keep in mind, though, that these can be helpful for management, but just using the traps really, in most cases, will not solve the problem for you. A reason for that is the traps only choose and draw in and attract one gender. So the males, you're not going to be drawing in the females, for example. And if a female has already mated and lays, you know, dozens or hundreds of eggs, that is just going to perpetuate the population. So it's not a magic cure-all for dealing with Indian meal moth or other pantry moths. However, it can help to a certain extent. One way that I am really fond of those traps, though, is as monitoring purposes. So if you put those out in your house, maybe you're not sure where a population even is because you see the moths in different rooms in your house, put out a couple of these traps, one in kitchen, living room, bedroom, and so on. Sometimes that can help you narrow down if you are catching most of the moths in a specific room. That would tell me the source is there. Maybe it's in the bedroom and maybe there's, you know, a Kid Chucked a granola bar behind a dresser or something and you just didn't know about it. That can cue you in on some of those clues for finding the food source. So it can help in that regard. If you replace them over time, you can also monitor, say, month to month. If you caught 50 last month and now you catch two, you know things are going in the right direction. So very helpful in that regard for monitoring purposes. But those are out there and usually not terribly expensive either.
Jane in Central Wisconsin emailed us. They have a post and beam house made with flat logs near a lake. They have a bird feeding area visited by many woodpeckers, and recently the woodpeckers have been pecking on the log siding. What might they be eating, and what can you do about it?
Yeah, and gosh, that's got to be just a frustrating situation because you can see them out through your window. You know you're pecking and causing some damage to the wood. Often in situations like this, there may be some sort of insect involved. This time of the year, it's going to be hard to figure out what that insect might be and not a whole lot that we can do about it right now. But one type of insect that comes to mind would be really a group of insects that I informally call fall invaders. These are things like Asian lady beetles, box elder bugs, cluster flies, brown marmorated stink bug, and other things as well. These are insects that seek out shelter in the fall. They sneak indoors, maybe get between cracks or gaps in siding and things like that. They might get under the siding, into wall voids, and the woodpeckers might be going after those. If we figure out that those are the insects responsible or playing a role in a case like this, what I would recommend is not doing anything right now, but other than, you know, talk to David Drake and Jamie Knack about things to do about woodpeckers and kind of repelling them if you can. But for the insects, take a close look at the exterior of your home next year. Look for potential entry points, cracks and crevices. Seal things up better with either caulk, expanding insulation foam, better weather stripping, and things like that. If we can prevent those insects from getting into your home, then they won't be there for the woodpeckers to feed on. And if the woodpeckers don't have food there, they're probably not going to be as problematic in a case like that. So that's one thing. We call it physical exclusion, physically sealing things up on the outside of your house. So I would maybe do that next spring, next summer, even late summer, just before fall when those insects are trying to sneak in. Another thing you could do, if you know you have a history of Asian lady beetles, box elder, and whatnot sneaking into your house, you could either do this yourself or have a pest control professional do it. You can do crack and crevice treatment. So you spray around like windows and doors and soffit areas on the side of your house to either kill or repel those same insects before they get in. We might not kill them outright, but at least if they go elsewhere and they don't sneak in, they're not going to be there for the woodpecker. So those would be two suggestions that I think could really help in the long run in a case like this.
Sounds good. Let's go to Jeff in Superior next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. I've always been fascinated by insects that transform into something else. For example, a caterpillar becoming a butterfly. My question is kind of philosophical, and I wonder if they've done any studies on it. Is there any self-awareness that the insect has about its metamorphosis? I mean, Are they aware they're changing? Are they aware they're more beautiful? Do they have a sense of self-esteem or some awareness of that?
Yeah, a really fascinating topic. Personally, I have not bumped into any research specifically along those lines, you know, insect sensing beauty and things like that. And some of it may be our own mindset, kind of anthropomorphizing things. Insects, you know, they may not be thinking of beauty with color on the butterfly's wings. They may have that color for mating purposes or things like that, or scaring away potential predators. Whereas as humans, we may perceive it as beauty. So I haven't seen research along those lines, but there has been some really interesting research going on more and more about insects and, you know, sensations of pain and things like that. So we are learning more and more about this all the time.
Interesting. That was a great question. You can join in, too. They'll get you on quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Jerry in Hazel Green called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondering how chemicals used on crops and GMOs interact with insects' chemical communication. Is there any work on that?
Gosh, that's a fascinating topic. My hunch is, my suspicion is there's probably been some research out there. There's a growing body of research just in general about human activities and how those can disrupt or interfere with insect growth, development, communication, somewhat along these lines, but a little bit of a tangent. Things like light pollution. If you have insects like fireflies and moths that are trying to mate at night and you have artificial light, it can throw off their behavior. So again, there's research in the general area. I don't know of a specific paper off the top of my head that has looked at like pesticides or GMOs and how it might be affecting insect communication. There very well could be some subtle ways, though, that it is. I just haven't seen those studies personally.
A listener emailed us this past May. They were traveling along the Bay of Green Bay, north of Marinette, drove through several swarms of bugs in extending from the ground to over 100 feet high and perhaps a quarter mile long. This was in the afternoon, and from a distance they thought it was black smoke. As well as being near the bay, the area is low. It's sandy. There's a lot of cedar swamp, and they couldn't figure it out. It was rather cool in April.
Yeah, definitely a cool description, and I've actually bumped into this myself quite a few times. My hunch in this particular situation, there's a type of fly that is going to look somewhat like a mosquito, but they don't have the elongated mouth parts that mosquitoes use to suck blood. These flies are called midges. We sometimes call them lake flies as well, because they're often associated with lakes, and the larvae will develop in sediment at the bottom of lakes. But they can emerge in these very, very large populations and form these mating clouds, where from a distance, it literally does look like smoke. Here in the Madison area, it's not uncommon to see these with some of the lakes around here, like Lake Mendota, where you may look across towards a peninsula called Picnic Point here in Madison and say, oh, there's a fire out there. Really, it's just a huge cloud of these insects. So anywhere you're near water, you can bump into these. Lake Winnebago is very well known for some of the clouds of these midges that we can get. There's a few other spots on the planet. I have a colleague, Dr. Claudio Gratton, in our entomology department. He has studied a specific lake called Lake Mývatn in Iceland. And if you translate the name of the lake, it basically means something along the lines of Midge Lake, because they get these huge populations every couple of years where it's just a gazillion of these midges come out at once. Massive transfer of biomass from lake to land and all sorts of cool cascading effects from it. But it's probably some of these lake flies or midges, which are harmless, mostly just a curiosity when you see these.
A listener emailed, while hiking last week nearing Elkhart Lake, they spotted what appeared to be a woolly bear caterpillar. Is this normal in January?
Yeah, if it's warm enough, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a normal occurrence. You know, if we had more seasonal weather, where temperatures were 25 or in the teens or something like that, probably would have been unlikely to bump into those. But if we have mild winter days, it's not uncommon to bump into things like woolly bears, the winter cutworms we mentioned. There's another one called the Virginia Tanuka moth, and those caterpillars can also be active on mild winter days, a few other ones as well. So not too unusual to hear about that with some of the milder temperatures we've had in part of the state recently.
Jan in Madison spotted some ants in her house this past week, just a couple, wondering if that's going to be a problem for her.
Yeah, good question. In my mind, the first thing I'd love to know is what type of ants are these? Because there's a lot of different ants out there. At least a couple dozen we could bump into in Wisconsin indoors. And each of the ants could have a slightly different story associated with it. If these were, say, carpenter ants, I might be thinking about firewood indoors or maybe some water damage somewhere. If it's other types of ants, pavement ants, odorous house ants, that could have a different storyline. Sometimes there are certain ants that come up through expansion cracks in foundation that are just a temporary kind of nuisance issue. So in a case like this, I'd say it'd be really helpful for me to see a sample of the ants so we can pin down the species. That'll help us understand what's going on. But they could potentially be a problem if it's a type of ant where you might have a colony living indoors, and if they're going to be active, that might be a nuisance around the house. So it would be helpful to know the species in this case.
Let's go to Wendy in Milwaukee next. Hi, Wendy.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I have something that the bug man told me was pantry moths, and I've had them now for, I would say, almost 6 months, and it's winter, and everybody thought they would be going away, but they're still flying by me when I'm sitting down, and I have traps, and I have enclosed everything. I never found the source of these moths, and I wondered if my birds or bird seed could be attracting this problem.
Yes, potentially. And we did talk about Indian meal moth and pantry moths earlier. And I mentioned that the most important step for dealing with these is to find the source or sources. And sometimes you look and look and look, you went through everything in your kitchen cupboards and pantry area and you can't find anything. And when that happens, my message is still generally similar though. Kind of double down, increase your detective work, see if you can find where they may be coming from. Sometimes it's things you might not think about right away. That could be dried flowers, potpourri, stuff like that occasionally can be infested by Indian meal moths, even decorative, Indian corn and things like that. So looking at those types of items can be helpful. Bird seed can be a common source for these. So if you have a bird seed that you keep indoors, I would take a very close look at that, as well as other dried bulk seeds, things along those lines. If you happen to have a history of rodent activity in your house, mice, that sort of thing, even if it was a long time ago, mice and other rodents will sometimes take food items, stash them away. In theory, that food could sit in a wall void for years until the insects find it, and then they've got a protected jackpot right there. So sometimes it can be harder. If you have really, really looked and looked and you can't find a food source, that's often a case where I recommend having a pest management professional out to really do some diligent looking. If they can narrow down potential or suspected areas, there's different types of treatments they can do, even to potentially address things in wall voids and weird tucked away spots like that. So I'd keep doing some detective work. Otherwise, you might need to call in a pest management professional in this case.
I remember Phil Pelletieri telling me he found some. He couldn't find, he looked and looked and looked and finally found it, found them in a vegetable seed packet that was part, that was open from a year before, or 2 years before, in the basement. And he finally located it after a long search.
Right. So sometimes it can be frustrating. One other thing I'll mention briefly along those lines. If you have had mice in your house and you had some rodent bait out, A lot of rodent baits are grain-based, and rodent baits are designed to take care of mice, not to kill insects. And so I have actually seen situations where there was some old rodent bait in a crawl space or in an attic, and that was serving as a food source for Indian meal moths or other insects that we generally see around a pantry. So sometimes you really have to start thinking out of the box in terms of what is plant or grain-based and could it be a potential food source for them.
Bill in Oregon emailed us, at Gill's Rock in northern Door County, you can see vertical webbing or cocoon material holding small rocks at fairly constant intervals. They found along the shoreline under rock cover overhangs between 4 and 10 feet above the water. They're among spider webs that do not contain any rocks or other materials. There's great viewing at a small park dive site with a stairway to the water. Otherwise, you need a kayak. They see them every time they go there, but have yet to figure out what creates them. So webbing or cocoon material holding small rocks at fairly consistent intervals.
Yeah, so that aspect has me scratching my head. Definitely sounds like a unique situation. Unfortunately, it's also kind of a hard-to-access spot. I'd really love to see some of these to get a better idea of what you're dealing with. A couple of things come to mind. I mean, with water and lakes and aquatic system, there are insects called caddisflies. And caddisflies are known for making their cases. Some species use little bits of gravel, sand grains, small rocks to build these cases. But those we would generally expect to see down in the water rather than being attached to rocks above water. So that aspect doesn't quite click for me. There sometimes are some types of caterpillars called case worms or bagworms. And some of the species will use foreign materials to construct a little case or cocoon-like structure that they live in. Although when I see those, it's generally plant-based materials that they use, little bits of grass, twigs, and similar things along those lines. So that really has me scratching my head. I'm going to have to leave this as kind of an unsolved mystery for the moment. But if you're up there, anyone's up there and sees these and can get me some good pictures, that would really be helpful for me to wrap my head around this a bit better because I'm just stumped at the moment.
Well, and that would really be cool to see anyway. I'd love to have a photo of that because I haven't seen that either. Well, on that note, we're all done for another visit. PJ, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's always a pleasure. We learned a lot and it was fun. Talking with you about all those insect sounds and answering questions. Thank you, PJ.
Yeah, it was a blast, Larry. Thanks for having me on today.
We'll do it again. PJ Leash, our guest today. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And if you type in UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab into your search engine, you're going to find out how to contact him with more questions that you might have. Coming up tomorrow on the show, it's time to gather the documents you need to file your taxes. Our tax professional is back to answer your questions about filing. That's tomorrow at 11 on the Larry Mueller Show. In the meantime, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you for listening, but do stay with us because there's lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.